Syria calls a war unwinnable. Today, Friday, September 20th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Syria's deputy prime minister says a civil war is at a stalemate, or as he told this reporter,
there might be an advance here or an advance there, but not more than just a tactical shift in the position. Strategically, neither side can win.
And later, a Hell's Angels retail store in Toronto where the manager doesn't want you touching the merchandise.
He grabbed me on the shoulder and physically pushed me out of the store and down the stairs.
Plus, recalling Duke Ellington's 1963 concert in Kabul, Afghanistan.
Along about halfway the concert, you see almost the entire audience rise and start walking, because that was when they had to go and pray.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run, at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The civil war in Syria is at a stalemate. Neither side can defeat the other. That's not my opinion. It's the view of the Syrian government, as expressed today by Deputy Prime Minister Kadri Jamil. He was interviewed by Jonathan Steele of The Guardian newspaper in Britain. Jamil also sketched out conditions for stalled peace talks in Geneva. Here's a clip made available by The Guardian.
Of course, the immediate ceasefire and putting an end to external intervention, having a ceasefire and the launching of the peaceful political process.
Jonathan Steele is on the line now from Damascus. Assad seemed to be getting stronger and stronger. How big an admission by his deputy prime minister is this, that neither side can win this war?
Well, I think it's very important because it reinforces the argument that there has to be a political settlement. So I think it's an important admission of reality.
And why does Deputy Prime Minister Kadri Jamil think the war is in a stalemate?
Well, he doesn't think that either side can defeat the other, that there might be an advance here or an advance there, but not more than just a tactical shift in the position. Strategically, neither side can win.
So what are the prospects for those peace talks? I mean, are they kind of set up almost to fail from the get-go?
Well, I think the problem is, as the government has always said it will attend. What was important about what Kadri Jamil told me was that he set out a kind of agenda from the government point of view. They've always said they would attend. The problem is that the rebels have so far refused to go unless Assad first resigns. Well, that's a precondition that's not going to be accepted. So it really requires the rebels' sponsors and allies, particularly the United States, to tell them that they just have to go to Geneva and come up with a reasonable delegation and some sort of platform for negotiation.
And I gather that Jamil's own party backtracked a little from his comments. What did they not like?
Well, after my interview was published, his people tried to argue that the entire interview had been just speaking in the name of his party rather than in the name of the government. But, the tape recording of his words, to me, don't bear that out. That's not what he said. And when I asked him about Geneva specifically, it was quite clear I was referring to, what would the government be proposing, and he gave the answers that I mentioned about ceasefires and stopping armed intervention. He never broke in and said, I can't speak for the government. All I can do is speak for my own party. So, he's trying to move the goalposts after, the ball's already gone into the net.
Jonathan, I can't let you go without asking you what Damascus is like as diplomats are scrambling to figure out the conflict and an end to it. I mean, what do you do in Damascus on a Friday night right now?
Well, I'm actually right now, as we speak, in the Christian quarter of the old city, and it's packed with people strolling around and going to cafes and restaurants, and, Friday's the day off here. It's equivalent to the Saturday night in the United States, and, the streets are packed, even though, of course, there have been mortars that have landed in this area of the city, quite a number in the last few weeks, So there is always the menace of that. The people relaxing, and it's much more pleasant in the evenings because of the heat in the daytime. I mean, there is this deceptive impression in central Damascus that life goes on as normal. And then you find that in many of these houses, they're overcrowded with internally displaced families who've been bombed out of their places in the more outlying parts of the city. So you have to get behind the facade to see the real horror of what's going on here.
Strange scene indeed. Jonathan Steele of the British newspaper The Guardian speaking with us from Damascus. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Syria is sure to be on the agenda at the United Nations next week. That's because it's General Assembly time. Streets in New York will be gridlocked as usual, with leaders from 193 member states making their way to meetings at the UN, as they do every year. Past General Assemblies have given us some priceless moments. Last year's was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech about Iran's nuclear program, where he used a very simple drawing of a bomb to get his point across. And who can forget Venezuela's Hugo Chavez comparing President Bush to the devil a few years back. Colm Lynch of The Washington Post is here to help us preview this year's UN gathering. There are some new faces, Colm, traveling to New York this year. One of them is Iran's Hassan Rouhani, newly elected. He's already exchanged letters with Obama. Do you think these early throes of, let's call it a like fest, will they continue and grow?
Who knows? But but the message here in New York and both in Washington has been, you know, a total 100% charm offensive. And you never know until they get into the nitty gritty of the discussions about the nuclear file to see how serious this is. But clearly the rhetoric is dramatically changed. I mean, the visits by former President Ahmadinejad have always been extremely kind of sort of contentious, very critical of the United States, making all sorts of remarks suggesting that the 9/11 attacks might have been invented, controversial statements about Israel. So I think that, you know, we're going to have a much, much, much different sort of atmosphere here this year. But we won't know for a while until, you know, to see whether there's really going to be substantive movement on, you know, whether Iran will ultimately agree to place greater controls on its nuclear program.
I trust eyes and cameras are going to be trained on Obama and Rouhani, constantly looking for clues as to the next steps in this relationship.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk about the possibility that there might be a meeting, that they might, you know, kind of, you know, gaze at one another across the luncheon room, or, you know, sometimes what they do in these situations is that, you know, you have staff in two kind of countries kind of arranging for sort of them to kind of walk in the same area so that they can say hello and maybe shake hands. But sometimes when they do this sort of thing, they don't necessarily want the cameras to be following or to document the encounter. So that will be something that everybody will have their eyes open for.
What are some of the other new faces who will be at the General Assembly?
Well, you have the Sudanese president, who has been here before, but it's been many years. President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. He was here in 2006. Since then, he has been indicted by the International Criminal Court on charges of genocide. So that's going to be a little bit awkward for everyone. There's a discussion going on within the U.S. government as to whether to let him into the country to approve the visa that he has requested. The Americans, there's a couple of treaties that were signed between the UN and the United States back in the 1940s that sort of require the U.S. to allow even sort of unsavory types into the UN for the General Assembly debate. So the U.S. hasn't said whether they're going to let him in or not, but it's going to be controversial either way.
Can Bashir actually get to the assembly without a visa and not be arrested? He'd have to fly to an airport and then helicopter to the UN. I mean, is that even possible?
Well, he can't. He's not going to get in if he doesn't get a visa. But I think it would be quite unpopular at the UN if the U.S. turned him back at the gate.
Colm, what are some of the other stories you're watching? I mean, obviously, there's no Gaddafi trying to rent tent space in the Bronx now. What's happening on the sidelines we're not paying attention to?
We're always interested in what do these meetings say about America's place in the world? You know, what does this say about the Americans' relationship with the United Nations? We're all going to be looking at Samantha Power, the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And then, you know, every reporters from all parts of the world will be, you know, interested in what's going on in their neck of the woods. woods. So there'll be a lot to chew on.
Colm Lynch, UN correspondent for The Washington Post, thanks so much.
All right, Marco, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
50 years ago this week, there was some musical diplomacy going on. Duke Ellington was on a tour of the Middle East and Asia, and that tour included a concert in Kabul, the Afghan capital. The BBC's Witness program tracked down the man who organized that show. Reporter Monica Whitlock takes us back to that day in September 1963 when Duke Ellington played Kabul.
The sun is setting on a golden afternoon, and an unlikely sound drifts across the city from the Ghazi Sports Stadium. It's the jazz legend Duke Ellington at the piano and his band, smart in their tuxedos, playing in the open air. For Faiz Khairzada, the young organiser, it's a marvellous day, a high point in his job as the president of Afghan Cultural Affairs. He'd built the stage himself and gone to meet the band at the airport.
It was very exciting for me to have him there in Kabul. I remember well the second number that he did was Don't Get Around Much Anymore. It was a beautiful concert. You know, the people enjoyed it thoroughly. It was something very, very new to them. The people in Afghanistan those days, even in Kabul, they were not that familiar with blues and jazz. They were more interested in the performance, how the musicians acted, and the trumpet and the clarinet solos. They were very much interested. They were awed by the thing, not so much by the music, but the performance.
Was the stadium full?
We had about, I would guess it's a long, long time ago, but I think we had somewhere around 3,000 and 4,000 people sitting in the stadium.
And they were just people who'd come in? Were there free tickets or they had to pay?
It was free for the audience, and of course the other people were invited guests, officials, royal family, etc.
A novelty for Kabul and for Duke Ellington. He later recalled Afghanistan as one of the most memorable venues of his career.
I remember we were in Kabul, you know. First of all, you figure out, you say, well, I wonder if these people ever heard of us before, you know. I wonder if they ever heard of Mood Indigo, because, you know, they got their own thing going out there. And it's good, too, you know. And along about halfway the concert, you see almost the entire audience rise and start walking.
And so he looked over and said, what's happening? I said, this is the evening prayer time, and that's why they're coming down. They're not leaving. So he had a sigh of relief, and then he got up and he said, oh, I'm sorry, why don't we have a break now? And he did it so charmingly. It worked very well, and it took about 10, 12 minutes, 15 minutes for the people to say their prayers, and they got back to their seats, and the concert continued.
Faiz Khairzada, the organizer who brought Duke Ellington to Kabul. He was speaking with Monica Whitlock on the BBC's Witness program. You can hear the full story at theworld.org. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Haitian novelist Edvige Dantika has a new book out this month. It's called Claire of the Sea Light, and it's set in Haiti in the fictitious seaside town of Ville Rose. The title character, Claire, is a little girl caught between her father's love and his intense desire to hand his daughter to a wealthy woman in town who might give her a better life. Dantika stopped by station WLRN in Miami, where she lives, to tell us why she chose to tell that story.
I wanted to write about that issue, that very moment that the parent decides, really with their heart tearing out of their chest, to give their child a better way of life in this way. I've had not a same kind of experience, but my parents left Haiti when I was very young to come work in the United States and left me in the care of my aunt and uncle, and there were many of us in that same situation. So it's something that I've always wanted to write about.
I mean, that whole moment where the departure may be imminent, it just tears at your heart. What was that like for you?
I didn't understand it because I was very young. My father, I don't even remember when he left, but my mother, I was four, and I remember we went to the airport and they literally peeled me off her body. I didn't know when I would see her again. So it's confusing in the moment, but as you get older, you realize the level of sacrifice. And certainly as a parent myself now, you feel so much more invested in understanding that choice because it's a choice that so many people all around the world have to make. So writing it this way, I was able to understand it both from the perspective of the child and the parent.
Now, the Claire in the title, Claire of the Sea Light, she was born as her mother dies during childbirth. The midwife called Claire a revenant. In Creole, what does that mean? And how does it kind of translate in Haitian culture?
You know, in Haitian culture, there is folklore. But in my fiction of Haitian culture, what I create is fake lore. The town in the book is invented, and so one has to invent codes. You know, there's high infant mortality, high maternal mortality in many places in the developing world, including Haiti. So in this idea of the lore, the child is coming as the mother is leaving. And in the book, the last words the mother says before she dies is "Vini, come." Mm. And one is not sure whether she's telling her daughter to come with her or to come into this new life. So in this book, in this particular context, Arivina is a child whose mother dies in childbirth, who then has to spend her life with that idea.
It's really easy to read Claire of the Sea Light as this really beautiful fable, but I see lots of interesting threads of modern Haitian culture embedded in it as well, especially like gossip and the way news travels around. Talk about that. You refer to télé-diol. What is that?
Well, télé-diol, it's sort of, you would say, mouth television. It would be a literal translation, but télé-diol is sort of a gossip network. It's faster than the internet. It's sort of how word gets around from person to person. And in the book, too, there is a story of a radio hostess, and radio is very big in Haiti. It's a right. medium of entertainment, of information. And the radio station is called the Adieu Oreilles, which was a little bit of sort of a wink-wink at the idea of the télé-diol. So you have the télé-diol and the Adieu Oreilles, and you're covered for information.
You talk about that radio station, Radio Oreilles, and the show hosted by this woman, Louise Georges, called Dis-moi, or Tell Me. Mm-hmm. She always begins by encouraging her guests to tell me a story, the basic currency of radio. And for myself, being in radio, I found it really fascinating. What is the role of radio in these villages in Haiti? And are programs like Louise Georges a staple, really?
I grew up in my house, listening to the radio, whether we had it on or not. It was always on somewhere in the neighborhood where I lived. And even now, when I go to the countryside in Haiti, where we stay with my mother-in-law, the radio is really the primary source of information, of entertainment. So it's a very powerful medium. And Louise Georges, the host of this program, tries to use it also as a instrument of justice. Mm. She tries to use it as a kind of way of demanding justice, which can't be found elsewhere, which sometimes happens in radio in Haiti, too. There's now some very powerful political commentary programs, call-in programs.
Do people like this radio host, Louise Georges, in your novel, do they incur the wrath of the community? I mean, they're spillers of secrets, after all. She's like the Julian Assange of Ville Rose.
Well, she is a particular kind of hostess, because I think she has a mission. But often people who do this kind of work that Louise Georges does on her program are on the side of the people. They're on the side of ordinary people. So they get the support of the community.
As far as radio production and style, what do you miss on radio in the U.S. that Haiti radio, at least in your novel, seems to capture?
What I love most are these call-in late-night stations on Haitian radio that sometimes you can get here on the internet, where people discuss everything from love lives between songs to these political programs. There's a program called Ramassé, which you can listen here online, where they, you know, they have the biggest political discussions of the day. So I think you have probably the equivalents of them here. But in Haiti, because the country is smaller and the political issues are sometimes so urgent, it can get very, very show, you know, very hot on the radio.
You just said how the debate sometimes on Haitian radio gets very show. And I was noticing that in your book, you shift pretty seamlessly in dialogue between Haitian Creole and English. When you write, how do you determine what language to use? And are you ever worried about kind of cramming English and Creole into the same line?
I try to write often the way I speak at the dinner table when my mother and my children and my brother's children, when we have several generations around, you find yourself shifting a lot between English and Creole. And I think sometimes that comes into my writing too. It's not an artifice. It's just sometimes there are words or expressions that I feel like are impossible to translate. So I will put them there and then have an alternate interpretation of that phrase, of that word, or hope that the reader will understand it in a kind of context.
Finally, Edvige, your book begins with a gigantic freak wave taking the life of a fisherman, and I, again, won't spoil the end, but it also involves the sea. Is there a belief in Haiti that the sea kind of taketh away, but it can also give back?
There's so much mythology about the sea in all of the world's cultures, but in Haiti, because it is an island surrounded by the sea, and we are here in the book in a culture of fishermen, the sea, I think, is a very interesting way to observe the environment. There were stories, for example, after the earthquake of people who had seen the sea completely retreat and come back. And in the culture of this book, the people live at the mercy of the seas. There's all kinds of proverbs about the sea, one in which is La mer pas qu'en bicrasse. The sea does not hide dirt. The sea does not keep secret. So the sea does give, the sea does take away, and the sea sometimes is the way out or not. And, you know, we came to Haiti by the sea, the Middle Passage and all of these other stories of how we crossed an ocean to get to this little island. So the sea is very much part of Haiti's beginning. And in this book, the characters fear that it can also be part of its end.
Author Edvige Dantica, her new novel, Claire of the Sea Light, is out right now. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
If Claire of the Sea Light piques your interest, you can check out a bit more. We asked author Edvige Dantica to read an excerpt from her new novel for us. You can listen online and read it for yourself. Edvige Dantica will read for you at theworld.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a campaign in Pakistan to get people to think of a daughter as a blessing, not a curse. Also, growing the plants of India in North Carolina. Oh, and why would a college student rewrite Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody to explain quantum physics?
Because I thought of it and then it couldn't not exist.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run, at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. In Pakistan today, imams at Friday prayers all over the country used this line in their sermons: "My daughter is a blessing, not a curse." That's the slogan of a nationwide campaign to change attitudes toward girls in the country. Sadly, Pakistani girls suffer from widespread mistreatment there. The preference for male children has also led to a huge gender imbalance. One statistic says it all, really. According to the UN agency UNICEF, around 300 bodies of newborn female babies are found each year, and that's just in the city of Karachi. That's the context behind the campaign and behind the slogan, "My daughter is a blessing, not a curse." Earlier today, I asked Pakistani author Beena Shah what she thought of the campaign.
I think it's a very clever idea. Now, the whole campaign is something pretty new. I have not heard of it before this, and it's really never been tackled on such a wide platform before. I do think it's a bit of a genius move to try and get religious figures involved in it.
Can you imagine being a fly on the wall of one of those mosques around Pakistan today or outside as the men discuss what they've just heard? I mean, what do you imagine they're thinking?
I think they're going to be very upset because, to be very honest with you, and I'm giving you my personal experience, fathers in Pakistan are very loving. They adore their children. They love their daughters. Anybody who was driven to do this to their daughter had to have been just seriously, seriously so pressured and so driven, so unbalanced by societal pressure and economic pressure. This is not the norm for Pakistani fathers.
I mean, given that love of their daughters, why do you think there is such a strong rejection of female babies in Pakistan?
It's societal pressure. There is still the all-pervasive thinking that a boy is more valuable than a girl for so many reasons. And most of those reasons have to do with economics. A boy is going to earn money. A girl needs to be wed. She's an extra mouth. She's a guest in the household until she marries and goes to her, quote-unquote, proper family.
Those are going to be tough attitudes to change, don't you think?
They are very tough to change, but at the same time, it's such fertile ground for changing. I mean, Pakistan's girls are really, they're so vibrant and they're so passionate. They're so eager to be educated at all ages.
Do you trace this to the attempted assassination of Malala Yousafzai, or is there something that's been kind of growing before that?
Well, to go back a little bit in perspective, Islam, the religion of Islam when it was introduced, and Islam being central to life in Pakistan, one of its key tenets was that you do not kill your unborn or your young daughters, because that was a practice in pre-Islamic Arabia. So we were always taught growing up that Islam came to change that. Unfortunately, there are still tribal customs and there are economic pressures that cause people to harm their girls, just as you see in India. We have the same pressures and the same problems.
And have you ever been kind of the victim of, like, seriously backwards attitudes about women, Beena?
I grew up in a very traditional family that was very conservative, and so I was not expected to be permitted to go to university. For example, I went to the U.S. to study at college and graduate school, and that was really something going against the grain. It was a difficult struggle for my family to go through and to face the disapproval of the larger extended family. And that's sort of the way it works in Pakistan. There aren't laws that say a woman can't do this and a woman can't do that. It's really more patriarchal attitudes that are embedded into the family through the authority figures of fathers and uncles and grandfathers and what have you.
Have they accepted your being a novelist?
They love it. They're very happy about it now.
Beena, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Beena Shah is a Pakistani novelist. She spoke with us from London. When South Asian immigrants living in the U.S. get homesick, they can probably locate an Indian restaurant or grocery store to remind them of home. But one Indian immigrant has found another way to deal with the longing for home, and he's turned it into a thriving business. As part of our Global Nation coverage, Jessica Jones of North Carolina Public Radio has a story.
Anil Gandhi moved to North Carolina from Mumbai back in 1989, lured by family and good jobs in the telecom industry. But today he makes a living selling the plants of his native India. As a sprinkler shoots water over exotic-looking greenery, Gandhi strolls over to a small shrine. A leafy herb called tulsi spills over the top.
In India, most of the Hindus' family, they have this in their backyard. And the ladies, they come in the morning and they bring the holy water and they take a circle and they pray to the goddess Tulsi.
The Tulsi plant, also known as holy basil, is one of the most popular items for sale at Gandhi's nursery, Vedic Gardens. He opened it 3 years ago in the town of Morrisville after realizing there was a demand in the South Asian community here for plants from back home.
Now it's come to a point where it's getting so popular that every single day I have customers calling from out of state asking me to ship plants, whether it's a Bodhi tree or holy basil or a curry leaf plant, which is another popular one.
As far as Gandhi knows, his business is the only plant nursery in the country catering to South Asians. He got started in the landscaping business 12 years ago after he was laid off from his telecom job. He'd always loved gardening, so after much thought, he decided to start his own landscaping business for the area's growing South Asian community.
So I went to do their landscaping and they would ask, well, can we put a mango tree in our yard? Can we put a tamarind here? Can we put a banana here? So that prompted me to research deeper into plants.
That's when Gandhi began collecting all the plants he needed from online stores and nurseries so his customers could find everything they wanted in one place. Today, they can find everything from spiky turmeric plants to several varieties of jasmine from India and the Middle East. Gandhi propagates most things himself from seeds he finds on eBay and in stores. On any given day at Vedic Gardens, you'll find people wandering through Gandhi's collection of plants with smiles on their faces. Sudarshan Narva moved here from Connecticut a few years ago, and he says there's one thing he always notices when he visits the nursery.
The smell, first thing, one thing I can correlate myself with what I used to be long time ago when I was in India, like the smell of the tree and the smell of the flowers and those things. So it feels like home. That makes me really happy here.
A few steps away, Sunita Prabhu is examining a cluster of graceful curry leaf plants. They'll eventually grow into small trees. Prabhu says it's important to have a good supply of fresh curry leaves for her Indian home cooking.
This one, if you take the leaves out of the tree fresh, it smells very good rather than buying it from store. So we thought of like keeping one in our balcony so that we can get fresh leaves whenever we want to cook.
Many of Gandhi's employees were born and raised here in the U.S. and didn't know much about Indian culture before, but they're learning. The nursery's in a town where 20% of the population is originally from South Asia. Amanda Hayter is watering a row of holy basil plants. She's a native North Carolinian who's happy to be part of this growing business.
It's definitely working. I mean, you have to think about the area that you're in and who you're selling to and be, you know, definitely diverse and open to new things. If you don't, you're just going to fail miserably.
As for Anil Gandhi, he says he never could have imagined as a boy in Mumbai that he'd end up running an Indian plant nursery in far-off North Carolina.
This is the country that gives you opportunity to do whatever you want to do. And that's what I've learned. Just honesty and hard work can take you way up there, wherever you want to be.
Gandhi says in opening the nursery, he stumbled across his dream job. He says there's nothing better than growing the familiar plants he loves and sharing them with others. For The World, I'm Jessica Jones, Morrisville, North Carolina.
Today's GeoQuiz fits nicely into a parking spot. We're looking for an Irish city where dozens of parking places have been transformed into temporary parks, street cafes, and art exhibits. Cool idea, right? It's part of a global event called Parking Day. The idea for taking over metered parking spaces was born in San Francisco about a decade ago. It's caught on in hundreds of cities around the world as residents reclaim open space in their crowded towns, one parking spot at a time. So it's Parking Day in the city we want you to name. This was once a Viking village. Now it's one of Ireland's busiest and most populated cities. The River Liffey divides the city into the north side and the south side. For the answer now, we're going to speak with David O'Connor. He's a Parking Day coordinator. He's at Smithfield and Market. And David, what city does that place you in?
Okay, well, I'm in the north inner city of Dublin, and we've had a very good parking day here in Dublin.
In Dublin. Dublin is the answer to our GeoQuiz. It's one of the cities taking part in Parking Day. Third year you're doing it there in Dublin. Tell us about these pop-up parks.
Okay, well, it's all part of Parking Day, which is a worldwide event, and that started in San Francisco. A few of us saw it happening and said, why not in Dublin? And this year, we've had 26 parks all around the city. Very simply, you take an on-street metered car park space and you turn it into a public park for the day.
So this is kind of the opposite of pave paradise and put up a parking lot. You're starting with a parking lot and trying to turn it into paradise.
We're turning it into various degrees of paradise. And we have a lot of very creative people doing lots of very unusual and unique different things.
Like what? I mean, I've heard about little parks, street cafes, art exhibits. What are some of the really outlandish things and creative things that people have done with these parking spaces?
We had lots of things. We had crazy golf. We had a cafe, a gaming arcade. That was quite. That was a lot of fun. That was they did a brilliant job. So they literally built a gaming arcade for the day. Different groups. We had a lot. We've got a lot of sort of NGO campaign groups. People like the Dublin Cycling Campaign, and they turned the space into a cycle park. We'd Sea Change that promote awareness around mental health. So they were using it to kind of make people think about their issue. So it's a very positive day, and the response from the public is 100% very thumbs up.
What about people who have cars and they're trying to park?
Dublin's fine. I mean, we take over 25 spaces. There's 20,000 on-street parking spaces in Dublin. Even the City Council acknowledged that that's too much. And by the way, the City Council support this very fulsomely, and they're trying to promote better streets and better places for people, which is really what it's all about. Places that people think, you know, we could do something better than park a car here for the day.
Yeah. When you heard about the San Franciscans doing this a few years ago, what occurred to you as, you know, being a natural fit for Dublin?
Well, we thought, what a brilliant idea. And it looked like so much fun and such an obvious thing to do. And I guess we're all sort of believers in a more creative city, a more cultural city, and a city that's friendlier for people. And it's the way cities are going, there's no doubt about it. And this is just one way of helping the city to get to that place.
I mean, Dublin is a congested car, crowded city. Are there enough green spaces to enjoy? Do you think Parking Day might have any impact on urban planning in the future?
We hope so. In fact, we know so. Again, the Parking Day people, they call it an open source experiment. So anybody can come along with their idea and actually gives the real urban designers, the people that are really responsible for streets and spaces, they get ideas from it. So it's almost like they see it as a kind of an experimental day. What could we do?
Is there one kind of little pop-up park or thing that's going on in one of these 25 spaces that you're just going to be going back to later on today before they have to clear out? You're just so smitten with
it? Well, it's quite interesting. Parking Day is, you know, it's a worldwide day. There's hundreds of cities around the world. But in Dublin, it's Friday, the 20th of September, is also Culture Night. And that's the night that lots of cities do this, I'm sure you know. But all of our cultural institutes and museums are open for free. So it's a very exciting, quite a buzzy night in the city. So quite a few of our spaces are going to brave it out and tough it out.
Wow, cool night to be in Dublin.
It's a lot of fun, a lot of fun. And it's a lovely Bami evening as well. We're having an Indian summer here.
Dublin is the answer to our GeoQuiz today. David O'Connor is a coordinator for Dublin Parking Day. David, have a great time.
Great, okay. Look, thanks a million.
Let's take a couple of minutes now to talk about theft on a massive scale. I'm talking illegal oil exports out of Nigeria to the tune of 100,000 barrels a day, or about $6 billion a day. Those figures are from a new report on Nigeria's illegal oil exports produced by Chatham House, an independent think tank in London. Report co-author Christina Katsouris explains that thieves get the oil using a process called bunkering.
Taking the crude from the pipelines and piping it onto barges, and then the barges then take the crude onto awaiting small tankers, and then those tankers usually either take it to make diesel for the Nigerian domestic market or export it abroad.
Nigerian officials have in the past said most of that crude goes to refineries in nearby Ivory Coast and Cameroon, but Katsura says the illegal trade is expanding way beyond that.
Each government has tried different ways to stop the crude theft, but it's still leaking. And as our report said, that there have been stories about it turning up in the US, some going to India, one cargo spotted in Thailand.
So what about the money trail? Well, it turns out tracking the illicit profits is tough.
Believe it or not, there is not a single case of crude oil theft linked money laundering been prosecuted so far. It's quite a low-profile business. While you can see it visibly in the Niger Delta, if you fly over, you can see lots of people tapping into the pipelines and the consequences and environmental damage of that. But once it starts going into the export market, it's very, very difficult to spot. It's almost invisible.
Chatham House's Christina Katsouris. The only way to cut the trade in illegal oil, she says, is to get serious about gathering evidence and pursuing the perpetrators in court. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. They've got an established brand. They've got name recognition. Why wouldn't they want to cash in on some of that reputation? Well, for one, they happen to be the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club. In the U.S., the Department of Justice calls them an organized crime syndicate. But in the Canadian city of Toronto, the Angels have opened a retail store. Peter Kuttenbrauer is a senior writer with the National Post newspaper in Toronto. He went to the Hells Angels store, which is simply called 81.
81 is the apparently a pseudonym for the Hells Angels. The 8 refers to H, which is the 8th letter of the alphabet, and the 1 would be A, so H-A. It's interesting because apparently, I didn't realize this, but unless you are a full member of the Hells Angels, you can't wear anything that says the actual words Hells Angels on it. But they do, and apparently for many years, have had a marketing business of selling their stuff to people with words that refer to the Hells Angels. So there are a lot of coffee mugs, and they say on them, support BRM. I asked what that means. It means Big Red Machine, which is another expression they use to describe the Hells Angels. If you weren't sort of in the know, you might wonder why anyone would want to buy this merchandise. It doesn't even say Hells Angels on it.
Right.
But
I mean, you'd have to know what 81 or BRM means.
Well, the thing is that a lot of people apparently on the street do know what these things mean, including people who are in the drug business. And I spoke to some people with the Ontario Provincial Police Biker Enforcement Unit, and what they said is that street-level thugs will sometimes buy this merchandise and wear it just so that other people will be intimidated by them, will think that maybe they're connected to the Hells Angels, that they have some pull, that they've got some friends, and that they maybe don't want to run out on their drug debts, for example.
Well, I mean, the Hells Angels have a fearsome reputation, but that is reputation. What's behind that? I mean, in Canada, have they been associated or implicated in any criminal activity that might warrant, you know, shutting down or preventing them from running commercial operations?
Yes. According to the police, the Hells Angels have 7 times been found in the courts of Canada to be a criminal organization.
So I gather during your visit to the Hells Angels boutique in Toronto, at one point you were not very politely asked to leave.
Well, that's right. I mean, initially, just to set the context for you, there were a lot of reporters waiting outside the place. There were a number of camera crews that had just opened. It was a big buzz. Everybody had descended on the place. And I think the Hells Angels were getting pretty skittish by the time I arrived. I walked in with a photographer, and the guy said, well, you're not a reporter or anything, are you? I said, I am a reporter, but I'm just coming to look around. So he let me in, and I looked around, and it might have been that I made a bit of a joke. I said, you know, I was asking some people on my way here if they wanted anything from the shop, and they said they were all good. And there was this other Hells Angel, an older gentleman with a white ponytail, who said, okay, you're getting out of here. Get out of my store. Used some pretty foul language and basically asked me to leave the store, which I did. There was a bit of a vestibule between the store and the street, and so I stood in the vestibule. I was still taking notes, just trying to describe in my notepad the merchandise, at which point he grabbed me on the shoulder and basically physically pushed me out of the store and down the stairs.
Well, as they say, live to ride, ride to live, and Peter, you got to live to write about this event at the Hells Angels Boutique in Toronto. Peter Kuttenbrauer, senior writer with the National Post, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Finally today, here's a song you know, but pay close attention to the words.
Is string theory right? Is it just fantasy? Caught in the landscape, out of touch with reality.
It's Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, of course, but as you can hear, the lyrics aren't the same. These words, they're about string theory. The lyricist is physics grad student Timothy Blay at McGill University in Montreal. And Tim, I was never really good with physics and math, and I love your song, but I still don't understand string theory. So help me out here. What is string theory?
Well, basically, string theory is this idea that beneath this reality that we know of that has particles or fields as the fundamental aspects of nature, there's an even smaller level, which is that all of the different particles are made of a string, a loop of string that's vibrating in space. And just like you would have a guitar, the same string can play different notes. These different notes for the loops of string become the different particles in the universe.
Wow, I think I might actually understand it. Mamma mia, sea of particles, as you say, right?
Yes, particles, vibrations become particles, right?
So if this 8-minute-plus video doesn't clear up string theory for adults like me, why do it?
I mostly did it because I thought of it and then it couldn't not exist, which sounds kind of strange, but this is sort of the way I operate with creative ideas, is I think of something that I love and then I just sort of have this compulsion to finish it. So the video is really made for me. It's not particularly made for the world, although I love that the world loves it. And I love when I make something that I love and see that other people love it as well.
And the world does love it? What kind of reception have you gotten?
Well, it appears that about 880,000 people love it at this point, or at least have seen it. I don't know. I haven't gotten that many negative comments.
That's not bad.
Yeah, I'm fairly impressed.
And the production, I've got to say, is killer. You went all out. Split screens of you. They multiply as the choruses build up. Even an Einstein sock puppet. How long did this take you?
Well, I wrote the lyrics last summer. I just started scribbling down the first couple lines. Is string theory right? Is it just fantasy? And I just kept going. I didn't get any work done that day.
I can imagine.
I was in my office trying to do string theory, but instead I was writing about string theory to Queen.
Yeah, when the muse hits you, you got to take it for a ride.
Yeah.
And your own performance background? Because you can sing, dude.
Thanks. I started singing when I was about 3, actually, in my mother's junior choir at church. And I've been singing in bands and music groups ever since.
You know, whether we get string theory or not, Tim, I want to hear some more of the song. So we'll say goodbye to you. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you so much.
Tim Blay, grad student in physics at McGill University in Montreal. Let's hear some more of his version of Bohemian Rhapsody.
What's their use? What's their use? Do they give us quark plasma? Can we build them eyes? What fraction of the strike this straight?
Nambu-goto! Nambu-goto! How to quantize, I don't know.
I'm just a world sheet, please minimize me.
Here's just a world sheet from a string theory. Railroad that drives by a vital symmetry.
Catchy little number, and you gotta see Tim's video for it. It's at theworld.org. And once you see it, I'm sure you'll be able to explain string theory to anyone who asks. Our own catchy tune, The World's Theme Music, was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend.
Oh, mamma mia, mamma mia. Such a simple particle.
So to get down to 4D, we compactify. Okay,
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.